This is Wyman and Bob
on Seattle Sports Station, powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
It's the conversation we all look forward to each and every week. A guy that just makes us feel better when things aren't going well, and frankly, they're not going well for the Mariners right now. Joining us on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline is our Major League Baseball insider, the one, the only, John Paul Morosi. John, how are you, man?
Bob and Dave, I am outstanding, my friends. And I have to tell you this, while the Mariners have struggled a bit over the last week, Julio Rodriguez looks great, taking very good at-bats. George Kirby's debut was outstanding, so there are better days ahead.
You're right about both of those things. Rodriguez looks great. He's a problem on the base paths, and Kirby, you couldn't ask for anything more. As for the rest of the lineup, outside of Ty France, who's just a pro hitter, and J.P. Crawford getting back in the lineup, what are you seeing with this team? It's just weird to see everybody kind of flat. You got so many guys hitting 200 or lower, and it's just, you know, guys with resumes in a lot of cases that just, for whatever reason, can't find their rhythm at the plate. And you got some nice pitching performances that really don't add up to much because there's no run support there. What's your takeaway from what you've seen recently?
You're right. And a couple of things. Number one, you're exactly correct in that the lineup has just collectively not gotten off to the kind of start the Mariners expected. That being said, the signs that we're seeing right now from Rodriguez, from Frazier, I think his at-bats have been better the last week, 10 days or so. So when you add all these players together, in addition to France, as you mentioned, Crawford coming back in the lineup, I really believe that top to bottom, this lineup is about to turn for the better. Kelnick, yes, there are still some concerns there with him. We have not seen him adjust in the same way that Rodriguez has. But I really consider when you think about at least four or five guys that you can base the lineup around, with Rodriguez, you hope joining in the likes of Crawford and France and Frazier, that should be enough. When the pitching is this good, I think for this team to reel off at least a solid stretch of 6 wins in 10 games, whatever it takes to kind of stabilize, because I do think the one concerning part, while I do believe this lineup is going to bounce back, I think the Angels are really for real. And I know we talked about them before. What we've seen from them the last week or so, I think, is only affirmed, not just the Reed Detmers no-hitter, but this is a very, very good baseball team in Anaheim. And so that's my one concern. I believe the Mariners will start to play better and win more ball games because situational hitting is going to get better. Rodriguez was one example of that in the past week. But I think in general, the big picture concern is the Angels are better than I expected they were going to be.
JP, and I'll take it from you. Just as an athlete in general, it looks to me like Julio is, as they say, not trying to do too much. And maybe that's what Kelnick is doing. I don't know. Maybe it's not fair to compare those two guys, but what do you see about Julio's approach compared to what Jared Kelnick's going through?
You know, I think it's a great question, Dave, about just the difference between the two. I think Rodriguez has a greater fluidity and ease to his game. I think Jared's game is power and leverage and the ability to, if the pitches are in the lower part of the zone, to just leverage them out of the ballpark. That's how his swing works. And what we're seeing now is that, generally speaking, pitchers are adjusting. And the hitters that don't adjust are being totally left behind. It's interesting that the big picture is that strikeouts have actually very narrowly reduced in percentage this year. But the overall average is not. And part of that might be the ball is not carrying. The ball may have changed since last season. The humidor might have some effect of it. Whatever the extenuating circumstances are, you're seeing an example on the Mariners roster right now in Julio Rodriguez, who tells you and shows you that adjustments can happen, even for young hitters. But Kelnick, I just think the way his swing is set up, it was almost as though he was designed to hit the way that pitching was happening 3 and 4 years ago, and he has not made the adjustment and had that ease to execute it in the big spots at the major league level. And it's tough. He's still a young player, and we have to keep reminding ourselves of that. But I think we are also at the same time seeing better adjustments made by Rodriguez than Kelnick. I think part of it is just the way their swings work and the general athleticism and ease with which Rodriguez can play the game.
Hey, John, what do you make of the new guys we brought over from Cincinnati? Because I feel like in one case, you're kind of getting what you thought you were getting based on the numbers. Eugenio Suarez is a guy who's got pop, and he makes contact. It's going to go a long way, but he strikes out a lot. He leads the team in strikeouts, and he's hitting right around 200. That's kind of what his number said he was. Winker was the all-star. He was the heart of that deal. And, you know, there was a lot of bad luck, it seemed, earlier, and now it seems like he's just kind of off a bit. He's hitting 204. I mean, it just he's not what he was advertised as being to this point. So is that – do you see them pressing? Do you see what is your take on the two guys that come over from the Reds?
I think you're spot on. I think number one, Suarez overall, you look at his numbers and it's a 735 OPS, which isn't great, but it's also about what you expect, and at least the power has been there. It's been a different story for Winker, who on Wednesday batted seventh, and that's just that's a surprising spot. That there's no way, no how did the Mariners expect that Winker would be batting seventh before the middle of May because of his struggles. And I think it's just been a low impact. There just has not been the same exit velo, the same damage that we saw, and he actually tapered off a little bit in the second half last year. He wasn't quite as dynamic of a hitter down the stretch for the Reds as he was in the first half, and so maybe there's a little continuation of a trend that perhaps the Reds noticed last season and may have contributed to their decision to move him. Obviously, they were moving a lot of players this winter, but I think in general, I just have not seen the same damage, the same just the same exit velo, the same sound off the bat, so to speak, and the same confidence. And certainly Winker is not the first player who's changed leagues and struggled, but that's what it's looking like for me. And we're seeing already, we alluded to it with Rodriguez and Frazier too, the players that have made the adjustment and we're starting to see better at-bats, it just hasn't happened yet for Winker. And when you consider the struggles of Kelnick and you add Winker to that, and then you look at the catching situation and the struggles there as well with Raleigh, part of the catching tandem, he continues to struggle. There's just a lot of outs they're giving up in the lineup. And especially when you talk about left field and right field, it's spots that you usually would look for to get some damage. And the same is true at DH a little bit, depending on how Torrens is doing or who the DH is on a given day. This team, I think they need Kyle Lewis. They really need Mitch Haniger, but they certainly need Kyle Lewis. And I think he is someone that they hope to get back here in the next couple weeks.
Hey, just real quick on a player from the other side, Bryce Harper. I want to say I've always liked him, but I really admire that guy. We talked to El Hombre Michael Bradley yesterday, and he was talking about how he just embraced Philly when he came to town. And last night he had an 8-pitch at bat that was just so awesome to watch. He started off 0-2, and you know, he battles his way back, just hits a quality contact double, just ripped one. And do people kind of love or hate Bryce Harper, or is his bad boy image kind of settled down a little bit?
You know, I'm really glad you asked about him, because first of all, he's someone that we've all talked about before as being a Kelnick comparison. In some ways, their games are similar.
Yeah.
But I think Bryce just represents someone who has continued to show up and continued to produce no matter what the noise is outside. And to be honest, guys, right now, I don't know how much he would acknowledge it. I think he's playing hurt with that right elbow. Obviously, he's in the lineup as a DH largely, but he hasn't really been right in terms of playing defense since the early days of April. And he is grinding it out. He is not 100%, and he is still batting third and giving quality at-bats, like you mentioned, no matter what the circumstances. And I think Harper was funny because for a long time, because of the persona, he's on the cover of SI at 16, all the publicity, he might have been talked about too much a little bit relative to his production. I think last year, and Billy Ripken said this well, and I think he's exactly right, last year we didn't talk about him at all, and then he won the MVP. And it was just a really ironic turn of events for Bryce, because sort of that consistency in showing up and doing damage and going to the post every day, even when you weren't feeling good, he really has gotten that part of his game down. He just shows up. He's just there all the time. I think actually it's kind of funny. It's true of Manny Machado as well. He's putting up huge numbers in San Diego. And he's not the same lightning rod right now. And so I really think that's a credit to Bryce. And hopefully during the course of this series, Jared took some notes about how Bryce approaches things. Because I still think that kind of a player is in there for Kelnick. But he's going to have to, I think, have those adjustments and those real heart-to-heart talks with himself to make those adjustments to get to where Bryce Harper is right now.
Wouldn't you think, John, that if Haniger were healthy and Kyle Lewis were healthy, that we'd be talking about Kelnick and AAA right now with the way he's struggling at the plate?
Yes, I do. I think that's a very good point by you, Bob, and I think it's exactly correct. There's just they don't right now have another excellent option to give him. And I think, too, when you have a clear move to make, to your point, if it's Lewis or Haniger, when you have the guy, send him down. Send Kelnick down. But you don't need to do it right now out of urgency to demote him just to demote him. But you've got guys in the organization who are just capable, when they're healthy, of giving you probably more consistent at-bats than what Jared is doing. And he needs to probably go down there and have a full kind of reboot and retool things a little bit. But it's really hard. If there's one thing, I've talked to players about this, and Dave, you could probably relate to this a bit in your own career too. You know, it takes a lot of work. When you're reformulating your swing or going through a slump, you have to put a bunch of swings in every day. That's a lot of toll on your body, and you're already spending a lot of your efforts at 2 o'clock, 5 hours before the game starts, and you're tired already, and then you're really chasing it. So I think Jared probably has to get to a spot where he goes to a less pressurized environment and get the at-bats, and I think, Bob, you're exactly right. If Mitch Haniger were healthy and if Kyle Lewis were healthy, I don't see a spot right now on this roster for Jared Kelnick.
Joe Girardi has what it takes to get thrown out of a game. Apparently Scott Servais doesn't. is he too nice?
No, a couple of things. I think Joe Girardi, certainly the intensity is there. And I think that both men lead in different ways. And Scott is, in my opinion, an excellent manager. Now, at some point in time, we can relitigate the manager of the year ballot from last year. But as we well know, listen, Scott is an excellent manager, and you don't have the success you have last year without having a great manager, which I think Scott is. He's just different temperament, different personality than Joe Girardi. And I've worked with Joe. I've done a playoff series and broadcast with Joe. He is as prepared as they come. I'll tell this quick story about Joe. I was in a production meeting with Joe as a broadcaster in a manager's office, and Joe said to the manager, "So I was looking at the video on your relievers, and I saw this, and I saw this, and I saw this." I mean, he was basically before a broadcast, and we all love our broadcast, but talk about prep work. He was scrutinizing tape on like the sixth inning guy to make sure he had everything down about this guy before he went into the manager's office for a meeting. That's how detailed Joe Girardi is. And I think it's just different personalities. And I believe that Scott probably has the best temperament for this particular Mariners group because of all the youth. And he's obviously done a good job of putting Kirby in a situation to succeed. Gilbert's taken strides. I really believe, guys, by the end of May, this team is going to correct itself. Just a question of if the Angels come back down far enough to make a division title realistic.
Well, John, one of the things that, you know, caused Girardi to get thrown out, interactions with an ump, obviously, and Scott Servais had it after. And I don't know if you saw the highlight of Luis Torrens after a check swing, called strike. He's walking up the first baseline and just flips the bat down. And the home plate umpire, whom he had his back turned to and was 45 feet away, threw him out of the game. I mean, I feel like we're spending a lot of time early in the season, John, talking about the umps for all the wrong reasons. Is it, you know, you can go to Schwarber's outburst, you can go to Madison Bumgarner, and the guy is sitting there holding his hands, like goading him. I mean, what does it feel like? They've been more present early in the season than in years past?
A little bit. I also think a couple things. Number one, the umpires, if you look at it from their perspective, they're kind of relearning what their place in the game is going to be, right? When you think about the automated strike zone, replay, pitch clock, I'm not going to defend their actions in all circumstances because, especially with Bumgarner, that was just totally out of bounds. But I do think they're trying to figure out, okay, what is our role here? How do we navigate this new normal? And I think some of the awkwardness has come from that. I also think that without the blown calls being as egregious in terms of plays that are now reviewable, we don't talk about that stuff anymore because it's been taken out of the game. So what we do have to talk about is this stuff. And I do think that in fairness to everybody, there has been, and this is pitchers, hitters, this might explain some of the hitting struggles too, it's like we're adjusting the strike zone on the fly. The pitchers are trying to throw the high strike again, and sometimes they're missing up, which was the whole Mets hit-by-pitch thing. And there's a lot of things changing all at the same time. And so for me, I think that maybe the umpires are caught up in this a little bit, where they're kind of trying to find their own way. But I do think with the Torrens example that you're describing, I've always been a believer that if the player is walking away, and that was true in Bumgarner's case and it was true in Torrens' case, I get there are magic words. I understand that. But if the player is visually de-escalating, it really should not, unless what he says is completely and just extraordinarily out of bounds. If it's just sort of a private de-escalating from you, re-escalate the situation. I think the old adage, and the umpires get this, by the way, like 99% of the time. So they consider themselves that it's a good game. If no one notices us, they will tell you that. I just think sometimes in the heat of the moment, maybe isolated incidents, they forget that. I think we've seen a few of those cases this year, probably Torrens being one of them.
Yeah, well, you know, Bob and I have been talking about how they're just not really doing themselves any favors. But you know, I mean, are we maybe a little bit too hard on them? I mean, there's certainly some nice guys. And it seems like, you know, when you talk to the players, I mean, fans are one thing. I mean, I'm a prime example. I love to complain about the officials, but you know, or the umpires. But, you know, as far as when you talk to the players, they're usually pretty understanding of those guys.
Oh, yeah. And listen, I mean, even if you look at a game where there were ejections and a bunch of controversies, if you count up all the interactions that happened during the course of the game, like next time you go to the ball game, count up the number of times batter comes to the plate, taps the shin guard of the catcher, taps the shin guard of the umpire. Mm-hmm. Or at first base, gives him a nod. Or there's a sort of a light moment at third base between the third baseman and the third base umpire. First baseman, first base umpire. They're talking. Even in the controversial games, about 97 to 98% of the interactions that exist between umpire and a player are positive. And listen, on that standpoint, many, many people describe that relationship as that of a colleague. Not as much of a – and listen, there's adversarial aspects of it, but we are all part of the game in that sense. It's almost like, not exactly, and you're lucky to work with great producers. It's almost like host-producer. The producer kind of keeps you in check, right? Right? And so, you know, there's that relationship there. And I would say player-umpire is not that dissimilar from host-producer, right?
Well, you've seen Lefko. He's terrifying, JP.
Yeah.
He's terrifying to Bob.
I mean, He is a great man. He is a great. He's made Syracuse very proud, and I am really impressed at his knowledge of hockey. I will say
yeah,
that.
Yes. Well, and speaking of which, we can't let you get out of here. And by the way, we're speaking with John Morosi, our MLB and NHL insider, in our weekly conversations with John Morosi, presented by Stanford's Restaurant. The Kraken end up with the fourth overall pick in the upcoming draft. I think the fix was in. They should have been top two, John. Some shenanigans. I'm calling shenanigans.
This is kind of like AL Manager of the Year, Bob.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, top. You know, what was it? Worst of the top three. Is that what we went with back then? Remember that worst? You had him last of the top three.
Yeah. That's right.
But to go back with the Kraken, at the end of the day, this is a draft where, to be fair, and I love Shane Wright. The difference between Shane Wright likely at one and Logan Cooley at two or Slepkovsky at three, however the order is, maybe it's one, two, three in a different order. But you're going to get a great player at four. There are a lot of really, really talented players. It's maybe more of a conversation as to who that player is going to be. Joachim Kamel had a great U18. He's from Finland. He's a name to watch. Cutter Goche is a name to watch. It's interesting, actually. Morgan Geeky's younger brother, Connor, is probably a top seven or eight pick as well. And sort of maybe pay some attention there. Matthew Savoy as well. So there are some good names there. I think the Kraken get a good player, and I would lean toward going with a center. There are good centers in this draft. The Kraken, in general, need more centers, true centers. I would expect they take a true center with their first-round pick.
Well, John, we'll definitely talk more about that as it gets a little bit closer, and you know, maybe they'll maneuver. There'll be some trades. Who knows what goes on? But we'll definitely get into that. We appreciate it, as always. Have a great weekend, my friend, and we will talk to you next week.
My pleasure, guys. I will say apologies on my slightly raspy voice. Allergies are in full effect right now because here in Michigan, we went straight from winter to summer. And I walked out of the house one day and I said, whoa, what's going on here? It's bugged up and here I am. So I'm not full strength voice-wise, but I'm feeling great and can't wait for next week.
You fought through it. You fought through it, man.
Amen. I appreciate it.
Thanks, JP.
Thanks, John. Michael Bumpus sitting in with us. We're going to talk more about Shane Waldron and this offense and what we've got to look forward to as we continue here. It's Wyman and Bob with Michael Bumpus in. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710.
Wyman and Bob.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
On Seattle Sports Station.
It is Wyman and Bob with Michael Bumpus here, Seattle Sports Station on 710. And Shane Waldron, you had a chance to catch up with him, Bump, and he was on with Mike Salk this morning talking about a few things. I want to play a cut for you and just get a response and see where you're at with what he said. Now, the biggest question on this roster is all around the quarterback. We don't know who the quarterback's going to be, what kind of quarterback they're going to be, and how are, more importantly, are they going to establish themselves, win over their teammates and everybody else. But here's what Shane said addressing that area.
Well, I think the biggest thing for the guys with Gino, Drew, and Jake as they're taking over their, you know, a new role, so to speak, in terms of, you know, not having Russ in the room, you know, just their process, you know, how they come to work every day. I think, you know, leading by example as that starting point. And in this league, the guys around the locker room, if they see guys working hard, you know, showing up early, you know, taking great notes, being in the front of the room, really trying to bring the meetings to life where they're asking great questions and taking the lead on certain installs. I mean, those are the little things in the off-season program that the guys notice, the guys pick up on, and then obviously the play on the field.
How mindful do these guys, whether it's Gino, whether it's Jacob, whether it's Drew, how mindful do they need to be of the example they're setting visually? Like he's talking about being in the front of the room, asking great questions, taking notes, to sort of establish themselves. Because if you think about it, I mean, Gino was a starter a long time ago. Drew was a starter for a bit and then was relegated to a backup, and Jacob hasn't even played. So it's a new role to be the leader, to be the guy again. How important is it to set that visual example that he's talking about there?
It's important because you're the leader of this franchise, but also that's what quarterbacks do since they're little, right? You're taught to be in front of the class, to take notes, to connect with all your teammates and stuff. So instead of having to follow one's lead, now they're the ones leading the charge. And that's pretty much, I think, one of the reasons why you keep Geno Smith around, to show these two young men in Drew Locke and Jacob Eason how to be a pro. Now, his off-the-field stuff is something different, but we know that when he's in the building, Geno is a pro. He prepares. He was ready to go when Russ went down against the Rams, drove the team down to win the game. It didn't happen for him. But it's a new approach. But Drew Locke has been there before because he was the number one QB before. And Jacob was there when he was at the University of Georgia and University of Washington. So there's some experience there, but it's different now not having Russell to kind of show you his way of doing it. They can maybe do things their own way.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, I think the thing we have to remember about Gino is that, you know, the good and the bad and everything. I think playing backup quarterback is the hardest job in the league, because especially if you're behind Russell Wilson, you have to prepare like you're going to play in every single game, knowing that you're probably not going to play.
Yeah.
That takes a tremendous amount of discipline. And so, you know, that's where I don't know that we've, or at least me, I probably haven't given Gino enough credit for that. The other thing is, though, like we talked about this year, Bob, about Dan Campbell, and, you know, he was the real deal. I mean, he's the head coach of Detroit, and he was saying all these crazy things and everything, but his players loved him because he was himself. And that's the thing about, and I talked to Lomas Brown, he played for a long time in the league, and he's a radio guy for the Lions when they were in town. And he said, you know, you're absolutely right. This is something that the players will sniff it out. If you are trying to be like a fake leader, yeah, or you're trying to say, come on, guys, or let's do this, I mean, it's going to be tough for these three guys because, look, you're following Russ. And Russell, when he transferred to Wisconsin, within like 2 or 3 months, he was elected the captain. He was of the team, you know, without even having played. So that's just the kind of guy he is. That's just who he is. So, you know, you can't try to be that. You can't try to be something you're not. You have to be yourself, or else the, you know, your teammates will sniff that out in a second. So, but I think it's going to be a difficult thing following Russ. I mean, we heard all the rumors about him having notes for everybody his rookie year, and he hits the ground running. His leadership is, you know, pretty on the spot. And whoever else, I mean, they're just going to have to try to be themselves. So that part of it's going to be rough.
Yeah, I mean, he did establish a different level of work ethic, whether people like him now or don't like him now. What was true about him was he was prepared, and that's what you heard from everybody, that he was – he sent the notes as a rookie to veterans, and some of it was poorly received, but he's always been that guy, uber prepared, and just in there early, leaving late, sitting in front, taking the notes, being prepared. So he's kind of set that standard. I would think Gino especially, and Jacob, since they were in the building with him, have a leg up because they saw, all right, this is what plays in this room with these guys. Drew's new to it. Drew's coming into it not having been around Russell, been around Teddy Bridgewater.
Right.
And that's not a knock on Teddy. It's just a different environment, different team. So it feels like that's where I would agree with Pete that, all right, Gino's got the leg up here going in because he understands the standard that's been set at that position and obviously knowing the coaches and the system and everything else.
And there are some things that you want to take from great leadership, right? You don't observe great leadership and just observe. Like, if you're not taking mental notes, like, okay, this is what he did in this situation, this is how I would handle a different situation, right? You make it yourself, but there are things like showing up early, leaving late, being prepared, making connections with people in Virginia Mason. Like, those are the type of things that carry on throughout any sport or any type of leadership position. Now is doing it the way Drew Lock does it. You know, we got clips of Drew Lock on the sideline rapping songs and stuff with his teammates. You know, that's something we probably wouldn't see Russ doing. Geno Smith, he's been in the league a while. He's learned from Russ. He's made his own mistakes inside the locker room and on the field. He's got a leg up on that. So it's a blessing and a curse to follow Russell Wilson, because this is probably one of the best leaders to play in this organization. But there are things that he did that isn't part of these guys' personality. So I'm with Dave. As long as it feels authentic and you're not forcing this certain type of leadership, then the guys are going to respect it if it equals wins or just playing at a high level.
You remember when Russ became the leader? It was the Chicago game. Mm-hmm. And who was the defensive end that was like, that's our guy? You know, who was the pass rusher that got hurt in Washington?
Chris Clemens.
Chris Clemens.
Yeah.
And Chris Clemens was kind of a hard egg to crack, you know. And so I remember after that, because Russ basically won that twice. But, I mean, that was pretty far into the season.
Yeah.
It's different because he's a rookie and these guys all have, well, Jacob Eason doesn't really, but they have experience at least, but that's going to take a while to sell that to the team. And I remember that's when the veterans kind of put their arms around Russell Wilson and they were like, this is our guy. He's a dog. I remember they were calling him. So yeah, that's the other part that's going to have to just take place. I mean, look, it's going to be growing pains. There's going to be some, remember Russ, the game at St. Louis where he threw like three picks. And I just remember everybody in Seattle that I ran into was like, they're going to bench that guy. He's terrible. What'd they do drafting him in the third round in the first place? And so, yeah, it's probably going to be tough either way, but hopefully that run game is really good and they're able to protect him a little bit.
Well, and it sounds like that's the way they're leaning, that it doesn't matter whether it's Gino or Drew or Jacob, that the run game is going to be featured, that's going to be our emphasis, is going to be the run game. And it's not that the passing game is going to be a complementary aspect, but that it's, you know, if you're looking at the priorities or which of these two weigh more, it's going to be the run game. I would be stunned if we're seeing shots down the field at the level we did with Russell, that I, you know, and I don't know if that's in the game of any of these quarterbacks, if they're, you know, how accurate are they when they're doing that? We know Russ was the best deep ball thrower in the league. Are you still going to try to, you know, draw up those plays with any of these guys, knowing, all right, well, they may be okay, but they're not to that level. So it just feels like it's a revamp of the offense and approach and maybe the play calling depending on who the quarterback is.
Yeah, you have your shot plays, right? You have your third and long plays.
Pete likes doing that, right?
Yeah,
taking shots.
And you can take shots, especially when you got the run game going, because now you got safeties looking in the backfield. You got linebackers looking in the backfield. So those plays are still going to be there, out there for him, but you're right. It's all about the run. And what do you do when you have an inexperienced quarterback or a quarterback that's hurt or a quarterback that's not in his group? You just run the football. So for the Seahawks, that's just going to be the base of this offense. But if you look at film on Drew Lock, he can spin that ball down the field. And when it's time for him to take a shot, I don't think he's going to be scared to do it.
All right. Coming up, which local team is going to make the playoffs first? Will it be the Seahawks or the Mariners? We'll talk about that next. It's Wyman and Bob with Michael Bumpus in. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710.
This is Seattle Sports Station.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob, brought to you by Angel of the Winds Casino Resort.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
All right, we continue here with Wyman and Bob. Michael Bumpus in with us, and I asked the question heading into the break, guys, so you've had a few minutes to think about it. Looking at where the Mariners are right now, which doesn't feel like a great place, and the Seahawks are the great unknown. They're coming off a very down season, and now you're without your franchise quarterback. We don't know who the quarterback's going to be. Which of these two teams makes the playoffs first, in your mind?
Well, I mean, we've got recency bias working here, Bob. I'm not feeling very good about our Mariners that are, what, 14 and 18 now?
Yeah.
I'm going to go with what people probably wouldn't think, and I'm going to go with the Seahawks. Somehow they are able to have a run game and maybe get a quarterback who's a game manager and squeak into the playoffs. And I don't say that with a lot of confidence, though, because I'm looking around the rest of the division. Yeah. I feel okay about matching up with Arizona, but...
And that's it.
San Francisco's always tough, and then the Rams, and then they're playing the AFC West this year. You know, that's tough.
Talking yourself out of it?
They're oddball. All the reasons why I shouldn't be saying what I'm saying.
Just keep in mind, 130 baseball games left to be played.
That's true, too.
100.
That's true, yeah, too. 30. They better go on a heck of a run here pretty soon. I'm going with the Seahawks.
Seahawks.
And that's kind of a chalk answer. I'm not, you know, ripping you for it, but it's so much easier to have a down year and then bounce back in the NFL than it is in baseball. It's built differently.
Bob, I don't think there can be chalk when there's only two choices.
I feel like that's going to be the most popular choice, and the text will come in. And
Well, because people are mad about the Mariners right now.
And, yeah. You know. What do you think, Bump?
I'm going with the Mariners. And I'm going with the Mariners because of what you said. There's a bunch of games left. We've seen this pitching rotation have their moments, right? Brash is gone. We've seen Kirby. I'm still pumping the brakes on Kirby because of the way Brash did me, right? I was ready to go once I saw his first start.
Did you.
Yeah, did me dirty. So I'm pumping the brakes on him. And then I'm looking at all the runners that the Mariners leave in scoring position. Mm-hmm. It's like they're getting guys on base. They're squaring the ball up sometimes. They're just hitting it to the wrong spot. I don't feel like they're as far off as the last, 12 games are showing you right now. So because there's time, because Julio's on, a seven-game hitting streak now, because Kelnick pinch hit the other day and showed, look, maybe he can be clutch, they've given me enough right now to believe, to whereas with the Seahawks, it's all speculation, right? I think Charles Cross is going to be good. I think Abe Lucas is going to be good. I think Kenneth Walker is going to be the number two running back and see all that stuff works out. But recency bias, yeah, I'm going with that. I'm going with the Mariners.
Who's the number one running back?
Ooh, Penny. Yeah. Penny starts the season.
What about you, Bob? Because that's a great question because, look, if Carson's healthy, it's no question in my mind.
Yeah, it should be him if he's healthy. But I think we're all kind of feeling like he's not going to be there.
Yeah.
And I hope all three of us are wrong.
But then, look on the other side and you're like, which Rashad Penny are we going to get? And that's where I feel like I said after the draft that I feel like Kenneth Walker might be the one guy who has the biggest impact on this team. I mean, look, Charles Cross is going to go out there and he's going to play tackle. And, you know, if he jumps off sides or gives up a sack, you'll notice him. But if not, you know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you'll see a couple of pass pros where he maxes a really good rusher out or, you know, drives a guy down the field. But for the most part, you know, an offensive tackle doesn't have like a visible, you know, effect on a game. Whereas I think Kenneth Walker, I mean, that's the biggest question mark, right, you know, other than quarterback, is Penny and Carson there, and what's going to happen at running back?
Yeah, I think Penny obviously goes in as the starter, assuming he doesn't get hurt in training camp or preseason, and if he's healthy at the beginning of the year, I think he's the starter. I have no idea who the quarterback's going to be. Obviously, it sounds like it's Geno's job to lose entering camp, as Pete says he's got the leg up. I don't have a ton of faith. I know I'm pessimistic about the quarterback room. So because of that, I'm going with the Mariners to make the playoffs first. And maybe more of that is built on hope. and rather than them being a proven commodity at this point, I mean, I just keep going back to last year when they went through that terrible stretch, losing 11 of 14 and just getting their butts kicked by the Padres. And coming to that, I remember we were on the air and I was just mad. I was just mad, just like, this team's not even competitive, man. They're not competing. They got beat 16-1 in one of those games. They were outscored 31-7.
Hadn't they been no-hit a couple of times?
They've been no-hit twice. Yeah, I mean, they just looked inept. They looked like there's just nothing there. And then you somehow, some way, with a taped-together rotation and one of the worst offenses in baseball, they win 90 games. So right now feels bad. 14-18, third place in the West feels bad. I just think there's more of a resume with the guys that aren't producing there, and I'm expecting that they're going to live up to what the back of their baseball card says in a lot of these. Not everybody. Maybe some of these guys are going to end up with an entire year that's a down year, but I just think there's more talent on this team. I think the rotation is better. They're going to find their rhythm. There's 130. If we were talking about this after 75 games, all right, I'm going a different direction. But because, A, I don't have a ton of faith in the quarterback room, whoever starts, and I hope to be pleasantly surprised and be dead wrong about it, I'm going to go with the Mariners and just more of the proven commodities that they've got that are underperforming right now.
Dave, I think you said it maybe to me a couple years ago. You don't rely on rookies in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Like, you cannot rely on rookies to win games for you. So right now we're banking on two tackles starting, relying on them. We're banking on Boye coming in and doing his thing, Tyreek Smith doing his thing, oh, Kobe at the corner spot. So because there's so much youth, I'm like, you know, and Walker at the running back spot as a rookie, you can count on a rookie at the running back spot. I mean, every year there's some rookie that does this thing, and it looks like receivers are going the same way. But the guys who protect the quarterback and get after the quarterback, we're banking on four rookies to kind of turn this thing around. So I guess that's another reason why I'm leaning towards the Mariners, because that was 2019 and 2020, right? Like in 2021. We're past all that with the Mariners now. We expect results.
That's not cool that you use my own words against me, Bob.
Using his logic against him.
Now I'm going, yeah, I did say that, didn't I? Can I change my answer? No.
That is, I hadn't thought of that either, though. That is a lot of rookie, a lot of youth, a lot of inexperience we're counting on with the Seahawks. And then that's not even taking into account the quarterback who is, you know, I'm looking at two journeymen. And a guy who hasn't really done anything, Jacob Eason, who didn't dominate at the college level, and we haven't even seen him at the pro level. And the other two are journeymen thrown in with the rookies.
Yeah.
That makes me feel worse.
Well, and then after the draft, I'll support it even more, your side of the argument. I wrote the article about how, you know, that's where all the athletes are out there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, those are the dangerous positions out there. Offensive tackle, you got to keep out some of the best athletes in the world, the defensive ends, and then corners. You're trying to lock down some guy that's, I always use Julio Jones as an example, but pick any, you know, DK Metcalf type of player. So, yeah, that's a lot of youth. And, you know, I just always, to me, a rookie, if you get something out of him, it's a huge surprise. So that's why, you know, I was big on Trey Brown, Alton Robinson, although, you know, we talked to Cliff Averill about that. I think it was more the scheme with him. But yeah, anytime you get a lot out of a rookie, that's just like icing on the cake. It's tough going into a season relying on those guys.
And we're relying on a bunch of them, as Bump just pointed out. All right, that does it for us. I want to thank our guests today, John Morosi and Michael Bumpus, for joining us on the show. If you guys missed any part of today's show or any day, just head to seattlesports.com, click the podcast tab, scroll down to our picture and click on that. It'll be right there waiting for you each and every day. Click subscribe, as Dave Wyman tells you each and every time, because...
Because you ask me.
Yeah, I make him say it, but it just makes it easy on you, the listener. You just click it once, you never have to think about it again, and search Wyman and Bob wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, what have you. We're on there as well. We're going to be back tomorrow, full show tomorrow. Mariners have the day off, so we have a full show coming up tomorrow with Wyman and Bob right here, Seattle Sports Station on 710.